Job is a wisdom book that is designed to teach us how to live skillfully. It teaches us particularly the skill of how to suffer, how to live when so much of life involves suffering that doesn't make sense. Job is a man who lived about 1800 BC. He loved God. He lived for God. God delighted in him. And yet, one day in heaven, when all the angels and demons came to give their reports to God, because they're accountable to him, God pointed out to Satan Job's remarkable godliness, Job's remarkable commitment to God. And Satan accused Job of living for God simply for what God gave him. Satan said to God, "Take away all of Job's blessings, and Job will curse you. He'll turn on you, God." In other words, Satan accused Job of being a God manipulator, serving God only for what he gets out of him. And Satan implicitly and much more insidiously accused God of being so unlovely that no one would ever live for him if he didn't give them blessings. So, God allowed Satan to test Job. God allowed Satan to take from Job everything, including his prosperity, his business, his children, his health. The only thing Satan was not allowed to touch was Job's life. Job was left to mourn. He knows nothing of why all this has happened to him. All he knows is loss, mystifying loss. About two-thirds of the book record Job's dialogues with three friends who believe that Job must have done something to deserve this. And Job keeps saying, "No, I've done nothing to deserve it." His friends keep saying with increasing intensity, "You must be hiding some sin in your life." And the book of Job is designed to torpedo this notion that good only happens to good people and bad only happens to bad people. The most popular version of this false thinking today is what people refer to as karma. Do good and good will come around. What you do dictates what you get. Sadly, I've even heard Christians say, "Yeah, that's good karma coming around." The book of Job is designed to torpedo that. You need to take the concept of good people only get good, bad people only get bad, and karma. You need to wrap them all up and throw them in a garbage can. The book of Job says it's awful. This is not the way God rules the world. He rules it much more mysteriously, much more magnificently. Job's friends are wrong. He hasn't done anything to deserve this. According to the first chapter, Job had done nothing to deserve this. To the contrary, he's actually suffering because of his preeminent godliness. There's no one else like him on earth. But Job doesn't understand that, does he? He keeps asking why. In the first round of dialogue, three times, he says, "God, leave me alone." He asks God, "Why have you made me your target?" Job accuses God of hidden cruelty. "It's like you've only blessed my life in order to take everything away from me when you find the smallest fault in me." Job says, "God, you've turned on me unjustly. You're not doing me right." And Job begins, especially in the second round of dialogue, to long for the day when he can go head to head with God in court. And he sometimes implies and sometimes says explicitly, "God, on that day, I'm going to be proved right. You're going to be shown to have treated me unjustly." According to chapter 19, in one of Job's most famous statements, I don't think Job has a clue about what he's actually saying. Job says, "God, we're going to stand in court. It's going to be written down all the things that have happened to me, and my vindicator is going to redeem me." Little did Job realize that God would truly vindicate him through the blood of his Redeemer. In the final round of dialogue, Job longs for the time when he stands before God argues his case, certain that he's going to win. So Job has repeatedly said things like, God, why? God, leave me alone. God, you're treating me cruelly. God, I don't deserve this. God, you're doing me wrong. God, you and me, let's go head to head. Job was not suffering, as many people have pointed out, because of sin. But in his suffering, he started to sin. A fourth friend, like Jim so effectively taught us last week, Elihu. He rightly warns that Job has crossed the line into accusing God of injustice. And Elihu rightly teaches him, God is great. And there are many things he does that we're just never going to figure out. So throughout the book, tension is building. We are longing, along with Job, for Job to finally encounter God. For God to finally explain to Job what he's doing, why he's doing it. Job, here's what's going on. And today we come to that climactic encounter. It's the encounter between the Almighty, inscrutable God and his suffering, confused servant Job. I'm going to take a lot of time to read the text, and then I'm going to apply it in four ways. So Job 38 is where we begin. If you're using the black hardcover Bibles that are available in the lobby, it begins on page 413. Job 38, verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm, out of the whirlwind. And he said, I'm going to do a lot of summarizing. He basically said, who is this that's questioning my wisdom with such ignorant words? God looks at Job and says, dress like a man. In other words, get ready to fight. God says, I'm going to pummel you with questions, Job, and I want to hear you try and answer them. These four chapters that we're looking at today are two speeches. Chapters 38 and 39 is the first, and then chapters 40 and 41 is the second. If you just count punctuation, there are 61 question marks. What is God doing in the first speech? Well, he begins by asking Job, do you control the wild occurrences in creation? In chapter 38, verses 4 through 7, he says, where were you at the construction site of the earth? Did you choose its measurements? Did you choose its materials, all the building materials? Were you there when the radio station that was playing at my construction site was all the angels praising me? Verses 8 through 11, he says, were you the one who gave the raging oceans their boundaries, telling the proud waves where to stop? Notice that the focus is not simply on God and his control over creation, but on his control over the wild, untamed creation. He says, I put strict limits on the ocean. In verses 12 through 15, God asks, are you the one who makes the sun come up every day, bringing an end to all that wicked people do in the darkness? Look especially at verse 17. God says, do you know where the gates of death are located? Verses 19 through 21. Are you in control of both the light and the darkness? Notice again, he's stressing his control over the darkness. And he's not just talking about physical darkness, he's talking about spiritual darkness. Verses 22 and following, God asks, can you control the water? Whether it's violent snow and hailstorms, or if it's refreshing rain that comes in the form of thunderstorms in the desert. It's verses 25 to 27. God asks then, can you control water? Did you design the rain to freeze up like it does? In verses 31 to 33, he points out several constellations that are warrior-like, beast-like. And he's using the constellations as indicators of the seasons. God set the stars in place for signs and for seasons. And God calls him to consider the great bear, or Orion. And he essentially asks, so Job, are you the one who controls the seasons? Did you set those wild constellations that mark the seasons in place? Verses 34 to 38, he asks Job generally, are you the one who's in control of all the weather? Can you forecast the weather? Hannah often says, it's not original with her, but she'll say, weather forecasting in Northeast Ohio is the only job you can be 99% wrong and still keep your job. God could have stopped there. It would have been enough to show Job his errors, but he didn't stop there. In this first speech, he moves into a second round of questions, not about the wild occurrences in creation, but about the wild animals in creation. God asks Job if he can provide food for the lions. In chapter 39, verses 1 to 4, he asks if Job designed the time for wild mountain goats to give birth. This is a really good paragraph, chapter 39, verses 1 through 4. It's a good paragraph to meditate on if you're questioning God's timing of events in your life. In verses 5 through 8, God asks Job, did you give the wild donkeys permission to be wild? In verses 9 through 12, Job, are you interested in using the wild ox on your farm? God's probably referring to the aurochs, which were bison-like oxen. It's been extinct since about 1600. They're massive creatures, 10 to 20% bigger than domesticated cows of our day. In verses 13 to 18 of chapter 39, God asks very humorously, Job, did you design and do you control the stupid ostrich? In verse 17, God says, the ostrich is stupid, it lacks sense, because I designed it that way. And with humor, God is very powerfully teaching Job that he's in control of the things in creation that make no sense. God asks in verses 19 to 25, did you design the fearless war horse? Did you give it its strength? He ends his first speech in verses 26 to 30 asking Job, did you design the hawks and the eagles to fly like they fly and live where they live and hunt like they hunt? Christopher Ashe, a pastor in England, points out that if you made a calendar based on Job 39, many of us have nature calendars with scripture verses on them in our homes. Christopher Ashe says, this calendar wouldn't be pretty. It would have pictures of flesh-eating lions, ostrich eggs smashed under their mother's foot, and eagles brooding over their most recent kill. And God is telling Job, in essence, I rule the wild. All the mess in creation, I govern it, not you. By the end of chapter 39, Job has been pummeled with questions from God, right? God summarizes his concern in chapter 40, verse 2. Look at it. He says, Job, do you still want to find fault with me, the Almighty, for how I've managed your life? And in verses 4 and 5, this godly man, Job, responds so humbly. He stands before God, says, I'm small, and he promises to be silent. I'm not going to talk against you. I'm not going to accuse you anymore, God. But God rings the bell. Ding, ding! Round 2. Here we go. God's not done with him. He says to Job again, dress like a man. In other words, put your gloves back on, buddy. I'm not done with you. God says, are you really going to keep on insisting that you're in the right and I'm in the wrong? Do you really want to fight with me? It's the first 9 verses of chapter 40. And in this second round is where our jaws should drop. God asks Job, do you control the wildest things in creation? In verses 10 through 14 of chapter 40, God asks Job if Job is able to put on the robes that a judge would wear and bring judgment on all the wicked people, all across the world. Job, are you able to make this world right? Can you deal with all the wild people in this world, all the sinners in this world? And then God turns his attention to a wild land animal called Behemoth. Behemoth, you'll see it there in verse 15 of chapter 40. Behemoth literally means the beast. And I need to get a shout out from all the Sandlot fans. This creature is described as the most remarkable example of God's creation. Its skin is impenetrable by a sword. Behemoth eats grass. He lives on mountains and in marshes. No one can tame this animal. What do you think God's referring to with Behemoth? The most common suggestion is a hippopotamus. Some suggest it's an elephant. Others, particularly since Henry Morris, have suggested that it could be an extinct dinosaur, maybe a sauropod like the Allosaurus. And if you've ever stood next to the 40-foot skeleton of the Allosaurus down in the Cleveland Museum of Natural History, you know it's a terrifying creature. But I don't think Job is referring to a dinosaur. He could be. I don't think he is. Because dinosaurs would have been extinct long before Job lived. The flood occurred some 2,000 years earlier. Another reason I don't think we should be too certain is because it's really difficult to create an accurate visual picture of something from Hebrew poetry. If you're wondering what I'm talking about, just try to draw a police sketch of the bride in Song of Songs from the description, the poetic description of her in that book. You're going to have some pretty crazy features. I don't think it's wise for Christians to use this portion of Scripture to teach that it shows that dinosaurs absolutely existed. I don't think the point is apologetics. And that even becomes clear in the next and final segment. God says, Job, are you in control of the wild sea monster Leviathan? This is the highest part, the final and most climactic encounter of God with Job. The focus of this entire chapter is on Leviathan. You see his name in verse 1, chapter 41, verse 1. Leviathan is completely untamable. He will not submit to the control of any humans, verses 3 through 5. He cannot be caught, verses 6, 7, and 8. Notice what it says in verse 10. Chapter 41, verse 10. If you're scared to stand in front of Leviathan, Job, why do you think you can stand before me? In other words, as one scholar put it, if you wouldn't pick a fight with Leviathan, why do you want to fight with Leviathan's maker? God continues in verse 11, basically asking, or saying, Job, I owe you nothing. I've created you. I own you along with all of creation. And then God goes on to describe Leviathan even further. His impenetrable skin, his massive limbs, his fierce teeth. Most fascinating of all is chapter 41, verses 18 through 21, where God describes Leviathan as fire-breathing. God says no human can conquer him. And that, verse 33, on earth there is nothing like Leviathan, a creature without fear. He sees everything that's high. He's king over all the sons of pride. What kind of creature is Leviathan? Some think it refers to a natural creature, like a crocodile or a whale. Those are common suggestions. But that's really hard to see based on the way God describes him. To answer the question rightly, it's crucial to look at three other passages of Scripture that refer to Leviathan. I list them there, Psalm 74, Job 3, and Isaiah 27. In Psalm 74, 13 and 14, Asaph refers to Leviathan as a multi-headed sea monster whom only God can crush. In Job 3, 8, Job seems to refer to Leviathan as a horrible demon who wreaks havoc throughout the world. And in Isaiah 27:1, Isaiah promises, quote, "The Lord will punish Leviathan, the twisting serpent, and he will slay the dragon that's in the sea." In other words, what God is describing to Job in chapter 41 does not refer to a creature you can find in nature. It refers to a creature that is supernatural. Dwayne Garrett, professor of Old Testament, explains it so simply. Garrett says, "Leviathan is supernatural. Leviathan is a dragon. Leviathan is Satan. Leviathan is the one that John sees in Revelation chapter 12, quote, "A great red dragon with seven heads, that ancient serpent who's called the devil and Satan, the accuser of God's people." The last words of chapter 41 fit Satan. He is proud. He's the king of everything that's proud. All the proud angels, all the proud people, he rules over them. So throughout this entire book, Job has been asking God, "What have I done? God, why is all of this happening to me?" And God never answers the question why. Instead, in this moment of climactic confrontation, God asks Job dozens of questions that basically boil down to the main point. And that is, the Lord is in control, complete control, total control of his entire creation, including all the chaos and evil within it. God essentially tells Job that he controls every wild thing in creation, like wild oceans, wild storms, wild animals, and wild people. And he controls things in the supernatural realm, including the wild leader of all God's arrogant enemies, Satan himself. God is saying, "You don't control these things, but they exist under my control." And this satisfied Job. According to chapter 42, the first six verses there, Job says in verse 5, "I now see God with my own eyes. I've personally experienced a fresh realization of God's absolute power." He admits to speaking things foolishly, things he was accusing God of, things that were just totally beyond him, too wonderful for him, verse 3, and he repents. Job says that what God gave him here is exactly what he needed. And it's all he needed. In his suffering, this was all he needed. Job just came to personally understand and trust that God was in control of this wild, seemingly out of control, chaotic world. That's the main point, and I draw four brief applications. First, in suffering, you need more than friends or family can provide. You need God. What you need most in your trials is not something that other humans can give. What you need, as chapter 28 put it so beautifully, chapter 28 is the heart of this book. You need something that you can't find anywhere on earth. Job's three friends most certainly did not give Job what he needed. Even Elihu, who pointed Job toward God's greatness, saying, "You need to trust God." Elihu, good as his counsel was, could not satisfy Job. Job ultimately found comfort not from a family or a friend. Please do not hear me saying that we don't need friends or family in our times of suffering. Proverbs 17 says, "A friend is always loyal, and a brother is born to help in time of need." Friends are wonderful gifts and wonderful supports, but as helpful as a close family member or a loyal friend is, they cannot satisfy the sufferer. Job was not satisfied after any human encounter. He was only satisfied after encountering God. Second point, in your suffering, you don't need to understand why. You can be satisfied and never understand the answer to that question. In fact, knowing the reasons for your suffering won't satisfy you. To the contrary, if you knew the exact reasons for your suffering, you'd probably still be arguing with God. Can't you hear Job? If God had shared with him all that had taken place in chapter 1, well, why me? Really, God, was that fair to single me out? Answers will not satisfy your craving for why. It's a craving that can't be satisfied. Because at bottom, the kind of why questions that Job was asking, it was a desire to be God, to be in the control seat of his life. And that craving to understand why doesn't need to be answered. It needs to be repented of. You don't need answers. You don't need to know why. The book of Job says you need to know God. Third, in suffering, you must personally encounter God's greatness. What Job needed was a humbling experience of God's terrifying greatness. And that's what every one of us needs in our time of trial. We don't just need reminders of God's goodness. Andy Nocelli points out in his article on Job, this is why God came to Job in a fierce storm. He says, God didn't informally pull up a chair and ask Job to have a seat on the couch and sip a cup of coffee. Job needed to be humbled. Reminders of God's goodness do nothing for us if we are insisting on taking God to court for what he's doing in our lives. If we're making accusations against God, we don't need to be assured of his goodness. Instead, if we're complaining at God, we need to be reminded that we are not peers with God. God's power and our power are not in the same category. Things in our world, whether it's the office desk or the kitchen sink, regularly go out of control, right? Under God's power, things never go out of control. Never. Job needed to realize that he and God were not peers, and he needed to realize that his wisdom and God's wisdom were not in the same category. God has reasons for what he does, and he doesn't owe us answers, as God told Job. His good plan is wise, and he has the power to carry it out, and that's all we need to know. That's it. We need to know that God is God. That's what Job needed. That's what we need. We need to personally encounter God's godness. There's no one like him. Now, Christian, if this morning you are feeling like God is bullying you, if you've prayed this week, God, leave me alone, if you've been accusing God of doing you wrong, if you're in that boat, you have to remember who you are in this world. You live between two infinities, the greater and the smaller. The universe has an estimated 2 trillion galaxies. Our one galaxy, the Milky Way, 100 billion stars in it. The closest star we revolve around, our sun, is almost 100 million miles away. Our one planet has 7 billion people on it. It's spinning at 1,000 miles per hour, even as the planet itself flies around the sun at 67,000 miles per hour. Every one of the 7 billion people has a brain with 100 billion neurons in it. Every human being has 40 trillion cells in his or her body. And every one of those cells stores 1.5 gigabytes of information. I've pointed this out before to you. It means that if you totaled up all the information stored in you, it is 10,000 times more information than all of Google's storage banks put together. If God created this universe and He created you, what do you think that implies? Do you think that this kind of God could have reasons for doing things that you might not be able to grasp? This kind of truth should lead us to respond like Paul in Romans 11. Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God, how impossible it is for us to understand His decisions. For us to say, looking at our trials, there's no good reason for this, as Tim Keller points out, it's just blind faith. You need to encounter God's glory in your suffering. And you can do this by spending time in creation, and especially by spending time in the Scripture. Spend time in creation. Because God has given us nature, even as we've been singing about this morning, even as we've been contemplating this morning in our worship. God has given us nature to encourage our trust in His power, our trust in His design, our trust in His wisdom, and our trust in His beauty. Nature can teach us these things very generally and repeatedly. But we should also spend time in the Scriptures. One great place to spend time is Job 38-41. I've personally experienced some really satisfying times of encountering God's greatness in Colossians 1, which Will read for us before. These kind of encounters will humble you. They'll correct you. They'll satisfy you. It's been said that what you need in suffering is not to grow taller, but to grow smaller. And encountering God's greatness will do that. Fourth, finally, in suffering, you must trust that God controls the chaos. There is a whole lot in creation that Job can't control and that we can't control. And we do well to recognize it. We're also wise to recognize that everything in creation, including Satan and every demon, is under God's control. Job can't control evil, but God can. Satan is God's creature on God's leash. And even though we might wish that God would make the leash a little shorter, God is the only one who, according to Job 41:2, can put a rope through Leviathan's nose. Leviathan is God's creature under God's control. And this is what we need in our suffering. When our lives involve suffering that makes no sense, when our lives feel chaotic, when we have experienced loss and we have no clue why and we feel like God's mistreating us, we must choose to trust God. This is humble trust. God, You're great. And I am not going to arrogantly insist that You explain Your ways to me. This trust is not only humble, but it's quiet. We put our hands over our mouths and we say, God, I am not going to foolishly accuse You of wrongdoing. I'm not going to find fault. I'm going to keep trusting. It's not only humble and quiet trust, it's also patient trust, and this is the hardest. It's saying, God, I know that time is eventually going to show that you're in control and you knew exactly what you were doing every step of the way. But that involves a lot of waiting. And when suffering goes day after day and month after month and year after year, it gets really hard. And yet we need to trust. I conclude by pointing you back to chapter 41, verse 8. God says sarcastically to Job, "Lay your hands on Leviathan. Remember that battle. You'll not do it again." He basically says, "Job, if you think you can win in a man versus beast contest against Leviathan, enjoy it while it lasts, because you'll never fight him again." Of course, God's saying, "Job, you're not going to win. You won't outlive that battle." But in conclusion, let me encourage you to think about this question. Is there a man that can pick a fight with Leviathan and live? There was one man who went head to head with the beast, and he lived to tell about it. And it's why we're still gathering 2,000 years later every first day of the week. Only Leviathan's creator could stand up to the beast and beat him. It is exactly what happened when Jesus, he is the one through whom Satan exists and for whom Satan exists. Jesus became man. He died on a cross to redeem those who were under the curse of sin and death. And then he rose again. He conquered death. He knows the place of death, and he walked out of it. In that man versus beast contest, the serpent bruised Jesus on the heel. But Jesus crushed the serpent's head. He beat him. Jesus decisively defeated Leviathan, that fierce accuser of Job and all the rest of us. If you're not a follower of Jesus, I urge you to turn from living for yourself and commit your life to the Lord Jesus, God's chosen King for this planet. I urge you to commit your life to Him today. If you are a follower of Jesus, then I urge you, in all of your suffering, do not fear. Your greatest enemy is under your God's control, and you don't have to understand why things are happening. In your suffering, long for your King. Long for your King. You know the King who conquered Satan. You know His power. His resurrection proves it. Long for Him. Long for His return. When Jesus returns, John describes it in Revelation chapter 20. One of His angels is finally going to seize this dragon that's had the death blow struck to its head. One of Jesus' angels is going to grab him. Jesus doesn't need to do it. A lesser angel can do it. An angel's going to seize the dragon, that ancient serpent, and he's going to lock him up. Your God is in control of the chaos.